Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We're going to have just kind of a fun catch-up, grab-bag kind of episode. I've been playing The Witcher 3 on Switch. There was some news this week, including a new Star Wars trailer, some Batman casting, a bunch of game delays, and then just this morning as we're recording this, an absolutely crazy panel with the Game of Thrones writers that we are going to make fun of plentifully. And I think that'll be a fun little episode for you guys.
Yeah, it's one of our grab bags. Nothing huge for an individual topic, but lots of little things have sort of popped up in the past couple weeks.
Yeah, because we were off last week. We had not been off in a while. I think we had been doing a pretty good job at that, but life just got too busy.
Yes. No, there's a lot of stuff. Yeah. Lots of job stuff going on.
Job stuff, and then I think I can also say you and I are both also working on some stuff we'll be recording later this year that should be fun, and so I think that's also taking some time because we're kind of working around some different plans. I'll tell you guys all about this more as it arrives, but I'm going to be out of the country for almost a solid month through December and January, so that's going to... We're planning to pre-record a bunch of stuff, so... But we are getting there. The end of this year is going to be crazy, Sean.
Yes, it is. Yep.
It is going to be nuts. I also wanted to say, before we dive into things, Sean, this is episode 303, which means that we have finally, this is a momentous occasion, Sean, we have reached the podcast number that is also the telephone area code of our hometown in Golden, Colorado, 303.
That's true. I wouldn't have, thought about it. You're not wrong. That is yes. My phone number does start with 303.
As does mine. So we're finally there. I wonder if we will reach the other area code in Golden and Lakewood, which is 720.
Yeah, when we're having that conversation, that'll be a moment for self-reflection when we're at 720. Yeah.
The area code here in Iowa City is 319, so unless something goes horribly wrong, we will definitely get there. But
looking forward to that episode.
Yeah, that would be very unexpected if you and I had a sudden falling out in the next 15 weeks that stopped this show.
Anything can happen.
Yeah, I mean, we've made it 303. Who knows? It's going to happen eventually. We're going to piss each other off enough.
Yeah, I'll be excited to see the movie that does it or the game that drives the wedge. Maybe it'll be Death Stranding or some bullshit. Maybe that's how it happens. Death Stranding, one of us loves it, one of us hates it, and the podcast ends.
I think the way that would have to work would be if you unexpectedly had a 180 turnaround on Kojima and just fell hard for it, and I somehow became even more disillusioned, and then it was just like, and then you started like, I think what would happen is if you, Sean, told, like, loved Death Stranding and then played Metal Gear Solid 2 again and tried to tell me how brilliant the ending is.
Yeah, that would do it.
Yeah, because you wouldn't be the person I know anymore.
Yes, no, that would, if that happens, call a doctor, like, notify my parents, tell them that something's going on, because yeah. I will never do a 180 on MGS2. The people who fawn over that game are wrong.
Okay, so, you want to talk about some stuff, Sean?
Yeah, let's talk about our stuff.
What's been going on with you?
Mostly for me, video game stuff. So, I finished Devil May Cry 5, and I'm basically like halfway through a second playthrough. Because the Devil May Cry games are designed to really kind of be played through multiple times because they unlock a new game plus difficulty called Son of Sparta. Because Sparta is the demon that is Dante's father. And so the new game plus sort of difficulty in those games is they completely redo all the combat encounters. So it's the kind of thing where in like the prologue mission, you're fighting enemy types that don't show up normally until like mission 7. So it's a completely different playthrough of the game in many ways. And Devil May Cry 5 is amazing. Like, that is a fucking spectacular game. I really, really like the way the story wraps up. I think they do a lot of fun stuff with the characters. There's like a lot of like surprisingly meaningful kind of growth among most of the main cast, particularly with Dante and Nero, that is fun and kind of seeing those relationships change. Like, as with all these Devil May Cry games, the story is not particularly deep, but it is always really, really fun. And I think this is probably my favorite story in any of these games. And so that part is really, I was like surprised by how kind of like effective I found the story by the end. But then the combat just fucking kicks ass. And playing through on the harder difficulty and going through those levels with basically all the main abilities unlocked with all the characters is hugely rewarding, tremendously fun. There's like some late game stuff you get with Dante, like you unlock the nunchucks with Dante very late in the game, which is a returning weapon from DMC3, which is one of my favorite weapons from that game, and that was cool to see them kind of bring that back and revamp that weapon. But so you only really get a little bit of time to play with that in the normal playthrough, then going through a New Game Plus where you just have that from the beginning, the nunchucks are super cool. They did a lot to kind of even deepen that weapon more from how it was in DMC3. And then Nero unlocks shit that is like completely game-changing for that character very close to the end of that game. And so playing through from the beginning with him, you have multiple new abilities that are hugely like change the way that character plays in ways that are awesome. So if you have played Devil May Cry 5 but did not check out and like go through a New Game Plus playthrough, I highly recommend it because that game is very different, and in my opinion of it has only like improved even more from like glowing to exceptionally glowing by playing through the harder difficulty and in playing with those new abilities and going through the game that way. Devil May Cry 5 is fucking great. It's one of the best games of the year, easily, for me.
Awesome. I want the Game of the Year edition that says on the bottom of the box, exceptionally glowing. Sean Chapman, Weekly Stuff Podcast.
Yeah, no, it's great. Devil May Cry 5 fucking kicks ass.
Yeah, at some point I'd love to do what you've done this year and play through all five and get to that point, because it sounds like a very rewarding journey with a giant pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Yes, yeah, it is nice that, you know, like I feel like a lot of times when you do this sort of thing with a franchise, you get to the end, and usually most franchises that are this old kind of start to decay and then die. And Devil May Cry 5, I mean, it's the Devil May Cry 5 came out over 10 years after DMC4, and they did not miss a beat. Like, that team just fucking hit the ground running. And yeah, I think DMC5 is probably the best one, which is pretty crazy considering it's not even like a genre of game that gets made that much anymore. And they have like kept the heart of that game basically the same since Devil May Cry 3, and it still works. Like, the game still is fucking great.
Awesome. And they're all on PS4 now, which is also very nice that we're getting to a point where you can just play things on one console.
Yes, that is very convenient.
All right. The game I have been playing has been The Witcher 3. Because The Witcher 3 is on Switch now, the Switcher, and I want to talk about the port itself because it's a miracle and it's really cool and just the experience of playing it on Switch. And then, Sean, I thought you and I could just gush for a little bit about the DLC, which we've never been able to talk about together because I didn't play the DLC when it came out in like 2016, I think, is when all that came out.
Yeah, so this is the Hearts of Stone and Blood and Wine, which are the two expansions. Hearts of Stone being, like, substantial but not huge. Blood and Wine being fucking massive and, like, almost like a whole game in its own right, basically.
Yeah, I mean, Blood and Wine is substantially closer to a Witcher 4 than it is to a Witcher 3 DLC.
Exactly, yeah. And they are both incredible, like, probably the best pieces of DLC I've ever played in a game.
Oh, not even with competition.
Yeah, Witcher 3 turns out very, very good, and when you get more really good Witcher, it's also very, very good.
Yes, and so we'll gush about that in a second, but I bought the Witcher 3 Switch port mostly out of curiosity. It wasn't even like out of an intention that I was going to sit down and play dozens of hours of Witcher again. It was, I am a portable gaming enthusiast, and I have been since I started playing video games, which was my first console, was a Game Boy Color. I have always loved portable gaming. It's always been kind of my home turf. It's what I kind of love most. I've owned every Nintendo handheld. I've owned some other handhelds. It's what I really like. And I'm always just kind of fascinated with what handhelds can do. And it's where I wind up kind of buying stuff just to dick around with it and see like what they're doing with it. And the Switch has obviously been a playground for that. I bought the Doom Switch that they did a couple years ago just to see, like, oh my god, they got Doom running on a handheld. What's that like? And when I got Doom on Switch, it was fun to, like, mess around with, but I never wound up, like, playing the whole game, and I don't know if I ever would. It was more of a fun experiment. And I thought Witcher 3 might kind of be the same thing, because Witcher 3 is, I think, pretty much without question the most ambitious port for the Nintendo Switch.
Oh,
I don't know
yes.
if... Yeah. I don't think anyone easily would argue that. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Giant open world game. Beautiful open world game, relatively recent game, not a whole lot that you can, like, Doom, you could cut from 60 FPS to 30 FPS, and that was one whole thing you could save. Witcher was only ever running at 30 maximum, so, like, lots and lots of problems with porting this thing. The port was done by Saber Interactive with a lot of in-house help from CD Projekt Red. They didn't just shove this off on someone else. They apparently spent over a year working on the port, so, like, they really... We're working hard on this. And then CD Projekt Red also really made sure the package was, I think, good for Switch owners. So it is the entire game, both DLCs, complete, you know, definitive edition of the game. They put everything on the physical cartridge. So a lot of bigger Nintendo Switch games, because the cartridges are expensive, they will just put some of the data on the cart and then make you download the rest, which is not great for a system that doesn't have a lot of internal memory and also kind of defeats the purpose of physical media. But they shelled out CD Projekt Red for a full 32 gigabyte cart, put the whole game on there. The game comes in a nice big box, so they could also give you the map and the booklet and the stickers and a little thank you note from CD Projekt Red and all that stuff. So they, like, really made sure this was a nice, like, copy that matched all the other ones. And then you pop in the game itself, and it's The Witcher. It's The Witcher 3. It's the entire game. It is, every NPC is there. All of the details in the world are there. They have not cut anything. They have not gotten rid of anything. They haven't substantially changed anything. A couple of little things, like the UI, are actually improved for the Switch, because I think it gave them a chance to take a second look at that. But, like, it's the game, and it is a worse-looking version of the game, obviously. It runs at 720p docked. It runs at about 540p on the handheld screen. There have been cutbacks to... You know, obviously resolution, things are compressed to fit on that, in that, in the size, the 32 gigabyte size. There is, the draw distance is still the same. Like, you can still see the entire horizon and everything. They haven't, like, cut that back. It doesn't look like Grand Theft Auto 4 on the 360 did, where you could see a couple feet in front of you, basically. Right. But you do have, like, foliage drop in. What do you call it? Like, phase in or whatever?
Draw in.
Draw-in, yeah. You have foliage draw-in is weaker in this version and things like that. But mainly it's a hit to resolution. Mainly you have assets that are compressed. But they've also been very, very smart, I think, about where to make sacrifices and where to do everything possible to keep it looking good. So, like, cutscenes and anything where people are just talking looks great in this version. They clearly put some effort there. So, like, if there is a face on screen, it looks like the face. It's like, Geralt does not suddenly look like a blurry mess. He looks like Geralt. It's lower resolution, but they did not make significant cutbacks there. Cutscenes always look good. On the other hand, there's things like if you're going through a really busy town in Witcher 3, like Oxenfurt or something. I think Oxenfurt always, or towns like that, Nilfgaard, all of these towns always pushed the hardware anyway. Like, the base PS4 had trouble with frame rate there, if you'll remember. And it still has trouble with frame rate here. And I think the decision they've made is, rather than cut back and get rid of a bunch of NPCs and a bunch of details in the town, they've decided, let's keep all of that. And if frame rate takes a hit, that's okay. You don't need the smoothest frame rate when you're just walking around town talking to people. But you do want to have the experience of seeing everything. So I think, like, they've made the right trade-offs here and there to make everything look good. And I think the things that matter most to me in the look of The Witcher 3, which to me is color and lighting. Witcher 3 is so fucking good at color and lighting. And then just the general, like, design and art aesthetic of the world is so beautiful, and you can't really destroy that. This version excels at all of those. I think the colors look roughly as good as they did on PS4. The lighting is pretty much all there. Like, some of it is not as dynamic, but it's like the god rays are there. The day-to-night cycle and all the different gradations in between is all there. It's shocking to me how much it looks like The Witcher 3 as you remember it. And it is entirely 100% playable. And I can say that definitively because I have played about 40 hours of this game since it came out, Sean. And I did not think I was going to do that. I was in the middle of another playthrough of Dragon Quest XI. I didn't think I was going to get this bit this hard by the Witcher bug, but I did, and I really fucking love playing it on Switch. I love being able to just take it into another room, take it on the go, just kind of play it in my lap like you're reading a good book, which is kind of what The Witcher is, certainly what it's based on. And it works extraordinarily well. You know, I think you've got to know what kind of gamer you are before buying it. If you only ever play your Switch docked, get it on PS4 if you have a PS4, yeah. Obviously. Like, it'll look better, it'll, you know, that's what you would want. If you don't like the Nintendo Switch and are a PC gamer, get it on your fucking PC. Why are you... I've seen some people complaining, like, it looks so much better on my PC. And it's like, yeah, it's not for you, weirdo. Like, that's such a weird thing to say. But if you enjoy playing games on your Nintendo Switch, if you would like a portable version of The Witcher, this is a more than commendable job. It is a phenomenal port of this game. If you only own a Nintendo Switch, if that's your only piece of video game hardware, then what are you doing? Stop this podcast and go buy The Witcher 3. It is as good a game as money can buy. Right, Sean?
Absolutely, yes. That for me is like... The use case I see for the Switch is if you mostly want to play it portably, or if you only have the Switch, like, then no duh, yeah, buy The Witcher 3. Yeah, if you want to play it mostly on, like, a big, like, 4K TV... probably that's going to bug you with, like, the resolution cutbacks. But of course it would. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's amazing that you can play this game, like, on a bus or something.
It's amazing. And on the handheld screen, I cannot stress enough how good it looks. Like, it's the magic. Because I did boot it up on my PS4 where I had a save in a pretty similar place where I was on the Switch version just to compare them. And it's kind of funny. If you're just holding... I think if you went PS4 to Switch docked... it would look really weird, right? But if you look at the PS4 screen and then look at it on your Switch handheld, it just looks like the game has been shrunk, you know? Because it looks like the game. And the cutbacks are there, obviously, but you don't notice them as much on a 6-inch screen versus a 50-inch TV. And you're just like, this is the game. This is the game in the palm of my hands. And it looks fucking gorgeous, and it's amazing to play. And I think I was also surprised how good a portable game Witcher is, and I think it's because the combat... and the movement and the general pace of the game is so slow. And I say that as a praise, not as a drawback to The Witcher. But it is kind of a slow, heavy-moving game. It does not require precision controls, really. It plays totally fine. And in fact, for story stuff or just wandering around the world, it's really, really fun portably. And then I'll say I've been astonished at how good it looks docked. It does not look as good as if you have the 1080p PS4 version running. But it looks good. It looks totally fine to me. And I'm not as picky about this as a lot of people are. I also do not have a 4K TV, so that might change things. If I had a... my TV is a 43-inch 1080p. And so if I had a 55-inch 4K, maybe I would find it more, like, less pleasing. But on the TV I have, totally fine. And I've gone back and forth, and I've enjoyed the hell out of it. And there is one... giant, massive improvement to the Switch version that almost makes up for every drawback, which is that they have drastically enlarged the UI for everything. So, like, the text size is bigger when you, like, hit the pause menu and bring up all your, like, you know, inventory, character, quest, all of that stuff. That's bigger. And not bigger in a way that feels like there's too much stuff on screen, just bigger in a way of, like, yes, I, a human being with average eyesight, can read this game now. Because it was funny when I put the PS4 version in again, I'm like, oh shit, that font is tiny. Have they patched in a bigger typeset yet? Nope, this is actually the large size I have it on now. So I really wish they would patch in for the other versions the Switch UI just as an option. I think people would like to have that because it actually looks really good on a TV with font that size. It's much easier to read. But it runs great. It's The Witcher. It's extremely impressive to me.
Yeah, and the UI thing is something that I think video game developers need to realize that most people cannot read their fucking UI. Because that's like every game now has tiny-ass font. I think mostly because game developers are mostly like playing and testing their games on monitors at their desk. Even if they're playing up on the PS4 or the PC, it's on a screen that's right in front of them, and so they make the text really tiny, and then it's like, well, nobody's fucking playing the game that way. All your subtitles are almost illegible sitting at a normal distance from the TV. That's something that I hope starts the developers start paying attention and saying, like, hey, because I know that there are some Switch ports that aren't making those changes to, like, the UI stuff, which then is, like, even worse for the Switch with a tiny screen and tiny text is impossible. So hopefully this is something that some developers are going to pay more attention to. Because I forget what it was, but there's something recently that I played It wasn't Devil May Cry 5, but there was something that was just like, oh, I can barely read this text. I just have to like lean really close to the TV. It was Control. In Control, every time I had to read a note, I had to just like lean really forward on the couch and be like, I can barely read this fucking note. This is ridiculous. My eyesight is fine. The TV or the text size is the problem.
I hope that whatever CD Projekt Red learned from the Switch port of Witcher, they bring to Cyberpunk. And it's like,
yeah.
I hope someone on the Cyberpunk team was like, hey, that Witcher 3 port has really good text. Hey, could we bump up the font size on Cyberpunk? That'd be great.
Or however at least provide the option, you know. Yes. At least in the option, yeah, because the Witcher 3 eventually patched in large text size, which is better, but it's still not large enough.
No. And I have to say, The Witcher 3 is such a good port for Switch that I think it outclasses some first-party Switch games in how well-optimized it is. Like, it has better text and UI optimization than Fire Emblem Three Houses did. It runs the Switch cooler and uses less battery power than certain both first- and third-party Switch games, like Dragon Quest Builders 2 from this summer, a Square Enix game, was kind of horribly optimized for Switch and just would run the fan like at top speed the entire time you're playing it. And Witcher 3, significantly more demanding, does not run the Switch particularly hot. And it's actually pretty good on battery life. So there's just a ton of things like that. Like, it is now, I would say, the gold standard Switch port for anything more taxing than an indie game. It is the gold standard, and I think it's what every other developer, and honestly, some first-party Nintendo titles should be holding themselves to. And, like, kudos to CD Projekt Red, because they have, I think, had that ethos of being really player-friendly like that, and I'm glad they brought that forward all the way to the Nintendo Switch. Very, very cool of them.
Awesome.
But now, Sean. So when I got The Witcher 3 on Switch, I started just with a normal playthrough, and I played the first hour or two of the original base game just to kind of see how it ran, and I was like, this is cool. And then I'm like, but I have played this before. I have not played Hearts of Stone yet. And The Witcher 3 has an option. It's on the Switch. I think it was also on the PS4 and Xbox One version. Where yes, with the DLC, yeah, with the DLC, you can just start a new game where it basically, it's kind of like in an MMO when you get an automatic level up. It just levels you to play to the level you need to play the DLC, gives you some gear, gives you all your ability points, and disables all the main quest stuff so you can just play it like it's a new game with all the DLC content. So I did that for Hearts of Stone. And actually, when you do that for Hearts of Stone, it also just automatically unlocks all the Blood and Wine stuff, and you need to level up through Hearts of Stone to get to Blood and Wine, but then you don't have to start another playthrough for Blood and Wine, which is nice. So I did that. I played Hearts of Stone. I was blown the fuck away. Now I'm playing Blood and Wine. I'm even more blown the fuck away. Sean, saying this is the best like DLC ever made for a video game feels almost like damning it with faint praise. Mm-hmm. Because it is so in another league from all other video game DLC. Hearts of Stone, I think, is the best version of traditional video game DLC that I've ever seen, which is that it exists within the confines of the existing game. It is a new story with what you already have, and I think it's the best version of that I've ever seen. I would put it above the Breath of the Wild DLC from a couple years ago. I would put it above like the Mass Effect 2 Lair of the Shadow Broker. Those are kind of the gold standards for me. Mm-hmm. And Hearts of Stone, honestly, is still my favorite story content in all of The Witcher 3. I love Blood and Wine. I don't even like the story there as much. I think Hearts of Stone is a masterpiece story.
But then what's nice about Hearts of Stone is that it gets to be very focused. So yes. It's like they added, because Blood and Wine is basically, here's like one third of The Witcher 3 of new content. So it's much more sprawling. Whereas Hearts of Stone is basically like a big but focused singular quest line that you go on. So it was basically like if they patched in another like Bloody Baron quest, more or less, into The Witcher 3 is what the Hearts of Stone is.
Absolutely. And then Blood and Wine, it's The Witcher 4. Like, that's basically what it is. It's another Witcher game. It's not as big as the base game, but it's like half as big. And it's a new continent with Toussaint. It is all new characters, and it is a new main quest line, and it's a bajillion new side quests, and it's just, it feels like, especially because I'm coming to it 3 years after playing The Witcher 3, it feels like I'm playing a sequel, and I love it to death. But let's double back to Hearts of Stone, Sean. Because I feel like Blood and Wine, when it came out, kind of overtook the conversation, and people don't talk about Hearts of Stone as much. Hearts of Stone is ludicrously good. It mm-hmm. feels like it. If you told me Hearts of Stone was just one of the short stories in the short story books, I would say, well, I've read those, so I know it isn't. But let's pretend I haven't read them. I would say, I totally believe you. It feels so true to the essence of The Witcher, which is it's Geralt accepts a contract. He thinks it's going to be simple. It goes wildly out of hand, and he has to do a bunch of crazy shit, including resurrecting the dead brother of the guy who gave him the contract so he can have the ghost inhabit his body and then go to a wedding and do crazy shit in, I think, the best quest in all of The Witcher 3. And it's just, it's a great, great story that I think along the way kind of just showcases a little bit of everything The Witcher 3 does well.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. They use the Man of Mirrors, Gondor O'Dimm, who that when you, like, go back and start the game again, you yeah. meet him in, like, the first hour of The Witcher 3. He's just, like, this weird dude at the table in the tavern you go to at the very beginning of the game. And he's like, what the fuck is this? And he, like, gives you a little piece of information that basically sets you off on that quest. And so then them wrapping back around on this weird, like, sort of, it feels like the, you know, classic American, like, Hawthorne short story kind of thing of, like, oh, here's this dude that's, like, clearly Satan, but we're never going to tell you he's Satan kind of thing. Like, that's basically who Gondor O'Dimm is. And then wrapping back around on that and then doing a whole story around him and then the guy who's turned immortal through that deal with the devil, basically.
Elgird von Everick.
Yes, yeah. The von Everick family. Yeah, it's like you said, it is basically, like, one of the better short stories from the short story collections, which are amazing. And is it's the kind of Witcher style dark fantasy short story I really like. Like, I really like the kind of Gondor O'Dimm-esque characters yes. and that, like, you know, packed with the devil story stuff. Like, I'm a sucker for that archetype. So yeah, Hearts of Stone is one of the best ones of those kinds of stories I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. I would put it right up there with the Bloody Baron as, like, the best thing Witcher 3 has to offer. And because it, like, it gets to be this sort of fleshed-out standalone quest line, it's also just so focused and so good at what it does. There's three big quests in the middle. One is this journey through this, like, portrait world to, like, meet Elgird's wife, and that is incredible. There is this one that is basically you planning an Ocean's 11-style heist, and that one is
right.
amazing. And then, it really is my favorite quest in the whole Witcher canon so far, is the one where you go attend the wedding with the ghost of Olgierd's dead brother, and the voice acting that the guy who plays Geralt does there to distinguish between Geralt and Geralt being inhabited by this ghost is some of the best voice work I've ever heard. It's such good characterization. It's such a good story about this dead brother guy, but then it also becomes a really good story about Geralt. And then that quest has the character Shani in it, who has mm-hmm. become one of my favorite Witcher characters just from this one quest line, basically. And there's a lot of good stuff with her and Geralt, and there's a romance option you can do with her at the end that results in, I think, one of the best romance scenes in the game. So, like, the whole thing is just super impressive. And then the ending is great. Hearts of Stone blew me away. And now Blood and Wine, like, I have sunk so much time into Blood and Wine, Sean. Toussaint is an amazing place. It also, you can tell, even playing on Switch, that, like, Blood and Wine was developed a year later because the graphics have just taken a noticeable kind of tick upwards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, on the Switch, Toussaint looks, you've probably seen the screenshots I've been sharing on Twitter. It looks amazing. And it's a really good story. It's another, I mean, it's also in the grand tradition of, you know, Geralt takes a contract and it spins wildly out of control, as it always does. These are never simple for him. And, you know, you get your own vineyard and you get to build it up. It's great. But I have to say, Sean, the biggest discovery of diving back into Witcher 3 for me has been I've finally been bitten by the Gwent bug.
Yes. Good.
Because when I played Witcher 3 on PS4 back in the day, I kind of ignored Gwent. I have to say I didn't quite, like, get it, quote unquote. But I heard from you and a lot of other people being like, Gwent is my favorite part of the game. Or, like, you know, like, I did everything Gwent. And I have not done everything Gwent because I skipped over the base game. But in what I can do through Hearts of Stone and Blood and Wine, I have done everything Gwent. I did the quest line where you go find all the Skellige cards. I did the tournament. I won the tournament. I went back to the main, like, continent of the game and went around and got a bunch of cards. Gwent is, like, one of the best card games I've ever fucking played. And it's wild that it's just this little side thing that I also think, as you've said before, Sean, provides some of the best characterization for Geralt. Because I think Geralt being the kind of guy who takes his job seriously and does a good job and has strong morals, but will also go into every inn in town and challenge people to games of Gwent just for fun. And he gets this little smile on his face when he talks about Gwent that he doesn't get anywhere else. I want that, like, that deepens the character in such a weird way to me.
Yeah, it's like, you know, everybody has to have a hobby. Everyone needs to have something they do for fun and leisure. And Geralt, more than most people, because his normal life is just getting fucked up by monsters and watching the people he cares about get killed and shit. So him, yeah, being able to ride into town, you know, and join the local Gwent tournament, like, you know, this is gonna make him happy. And it's like, you want to see Geralt be happy. And yes, it's... one of my favorite things about that game is just the Geralt, like, the Gwent maniac, just like talking to someone and be like, okay, yeah, no, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, your wife got eaten by a werewolf, I get it. Anyways, you want to play Gwent? Like, how about a game of Gwent? It'll make you feel way better. Come on, buddy.
It's so good. I also really love the Skellige deck they added in Blood and Wine. Mm-hmm. It's really cool. And then I also love the dwarves in Blood and Wine who hate that they've added a Skellige deck. And they're protesting the tournament. It's great. So I think I'm like probably 2/3 of the way through the Blood and Wine main quest. And the story is definitely heating up. I just had a very juicy scene that was really good. And I'm excited to see where that will go. But I'm also like in full Witcher 3 mode where like I spent most of the past week just ignoring the main quest entirely and doing a ton of other stuff. And that's how you know you're in it. And without even noticing, Sean, I checked my play clock the other day on the Switch's internal play clock, and I was at 35 hours. I was like, shit, I didn't mean to do this. Witcher 3 is just that good.
It's so fucking good. Yeah, like, you posting those screenshots, and just, like, people talking about the game again because of the Switch port, I, like, have this incredibly powerful urge to play through the Witcher 3 again, because it's been 4 years. Which yeah. is, it seems, it feels crazy that it's been 4 years. So maybe this summer or something, I will go through and play. Because I played through, like, the first half of The Witcher 3. I got, like, into Novigrad on a playthrough on the hardest difficulty and kind of fell off because other games came out. I might try to push through and do a full playthrough this summer. Especially because I do want to, I particularly, maybe all the, maybe what I'll just do is do the Hearts of Stone and Blood and Wine stuff again to get, like, that focused Witcher and not have to spend 90 hours playing the whole game. Just only spend a measly 50 hours doing all of Hearts of Stone and Blood and Wine, because yeah, Witcher 3 is one of the best games ever made, like, and yeah. and some of the best stuff in The Witcher 3 is in that DLC. So if people have not played it, like, you and if you want to play the portable version of The Witcher 3, like, as you said, the game just allows you to create a character that is leveled up to the place of the DLC. So there's if you never got around to it before, there's no better time to get into The Witcher 3.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm very glad I've played it again, as, let's just say, best of the decade lists are coming up, because it's a contender. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish I had played more of it before we did our big top 10 video games of all time list, Sean, a couple years ago, because thinking about it now, I think Witcher 3 would be on there for me. But yeah, I just, it was like, it was like too distant for me at the time, because it had been a couple years since I played it and I never did the DLC. But yeah, it's so fucking good. And, you know, we'll have another chance to talk about The Witcher when the Netflix show comes out.
Right. Jesus, I had completely forgotten that was happening.
I think everyone did. All right. Any other stuff you've been up to before we move on?
Yes, because there is another game I've played. I've played through the campaign of Call of Duty Modern Warfare, the latest Call of Duty game. And it's interesting. I have like really complicated feelings about the campaign. So just like to recap, because we talked about it when the beta came out, and I feel like probably I would have a much more glowing overall impressions if I had not already played like 15 hours of this game in the beta and talked about it then. But Modern Warfare is the biggest sort of leap up that Call of Duty has had. Probably since the original Modern Warfare, since Call of Duty 4. They've been basically just building off of Call of Duty 4 since that game in 2007. This game, from like the sort of bones, feels different. It's still clearly identifiably Call of Duty. They didn't turn it into like a fucking tactics game or something. But it is Like the feel
I would love
of the
a
game.
Call of Duty Tactics game. That sounds yeah. great. Don't tease me, Sean.
Call of Duty Tactics. Yeah. They will do it eventually. Once Call of Duty's like sun has set and they're just mining everything they can out of that franchise, we will get our Call of Duty Tactics game. But yeah, so this game, like all the sort of core gameplay feels modern and updated and renovated. Like just like the physics, the animations, just the graphical quality and the sound design in particular is all just like substantially better and updated and feels revamped. And it feels like, it almost feels like they should have done this game in a year or two and just like done this for the new consoles, and it would have felt like almost like more of a clean like reboot of the franchise in a weird way. But so all of those things that I talked about with the beta in regards to that gameplay feel, all that obviously holds true for the campaign. And in particular, the graphics, it looks great in multiplayer. The campaign where they can kind of design vistas and locations and don't have to worry about like visibility and things like that, that kind of make the multiplayer modes in most games like look a little bit washed out or something because they want things to be very easily readable. They don't have to worry about that as much in campaign. And so the campaign is, I think, one of the best looking games I've ever seen. Like, it is unbelievably gorgeous, especially if you have an HDR TV. I think this is the best implementation of HDR I've seen. The color palette is really rich. There's a huge variety of different locales and environments they take you to. So there's a really great like variety of, you know, the deserts in the Middle East and sort of like modern urban cityscapes and like really detailed housing complexes and stuff. There's a lot of different kind of visual variety in the game. And the lighting and color is so vivid. And things like explosions and fire are incredibly bright. And kind of, again, with like an HDR TV, that the contrast between the night, like sky and like trees on fire is so stark and clear. And there's a lot of artistry gone into that visual element of the game that I think it is an incredible visual showcase in a way that Call of Duty almost never really is. Call of Duty is always nice looking, but it's never like at the peak of sort of like what is being offered visually in games. And this is the first time where I feel like this is one of the best looking games I've played this year. I think it is utterly fucking gorgeous.
Can I just ask how big an install it is on PS4? Because I've heard the PC size is ridiculous.
It's big. I don't know because it's weird. They make you download, because I have the digital version of the game, and they make you download the pieces of the game separately. So it's like, it's actually like four or five different downloads. Cause there's one that's like 15 gigs that is just called Call of Duty Modern Warfare. And then there's like campaign pack and multiplayer pack and Spec Ops pack. It's a really weird setup. I have no idea if you can do the thing they're talking about with the PS5 of just delete the campaign pack when you're done with it. I should try that now that I've finished the campaign and see if the rest of the game still works. But I don't think it's as big. It's not like 150 gigs for sure.
Okay.
Like the PC version is, which I suspect the PC version is not actually 150 gigs. It probably, you have to have 150 gigs free on your hard drive to install it. And then it probably uses that space and then like deletes a bunch of stuff for the actual install. But it's a big install, but it's not, here's 120 gigabytes, like say goodbye to your hard drive space. But yes. So anyways, back to the game. Gorgeous. The sound design is probably the best I've had in a game like this. Like the grenades and gunfire and stuff is very stark and clear and crisp sounding. There's like a lot of dynamic range to the audio that sounds really great. And so all that stuff, true about the multiplayer, also very true about the campaign. But where I have like kind of like mixed or complicated feelings about the campaign is I think a lot of the mission design and gameplay is phenomenal. Like there are a couple of levels in the campaign that are among the best levels I've played in a Call of Duty campaign. There's one about halfway through involving you kind of trying to protect a high value target in an American embassy, and they attack the embassy and you have to kind of defend him and then get out of the embassy and hold down a position to try to like get exfil and all this stuff. And it's a really great mission that has a lot of different sort of like moving parts to it, and it's a really well constructed full mission. There's a mission near the end of the game that is very stealth focused that I also think is one of the best things that Call of Duty has ever done in terms of mission design. but the story is incredibly dumb. Like, it is, especially as a follow-up to Infinite Warfare, which is easily the best campaign that Call of Duty has had, which I reconfirmed when I replayed that campaign earlier this year. This being the next Infinity Ward game after that makes it very disappointing, because it's like a very... This is another Call of Duty campaign kind of story. It's got a bunch of like, oh, here's like something to be like very kind of like shocking and make you think about the morality of blah, 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 in a way that feels very juvenile. In like nothing I would say that's like quite as eye rolling to me as No Russian was for Modern Warfare 2. But it is still in that tradition of Call of Duty campaigns where it felt like Infinite Warfare had like really separated itself from a lot of the design ethos in terms of the narrative quality of other Call of Duty campaigns, even just down to like the whole structure of that campaign with like a hub and all that kind of stuff is totally different. This goes back to which, you know, all the games between Infinite Warfare and now made by other studios have done this also. So saying go back to is kind of weird. That game is just like a total exception. This is like all other Call of Duty campaigns, straight linear mission structure. It's about 6 to 7 hours long. I played on the hardened difficulty, so one up above from normal. So I probably died more than you would, so it probably took me a little bit longer. So you could probably get through like 5 hours on the regular difficulty. And it's just like, ooh-rah, like military, yeah, let's go defeat the bad guys. But are we really the bad guys? Maybe, but it's the individual soldiers are good, the systems of power are bad, and let's not investigate it any more than that, and then the story's over. And it's that kind of thing, in a way that Infinite Warfare got so much deeper and mined so much sort of like emotional and thematic richness out of the campaign that it had, that it is very disappointing to go back to something that's just like, man, we really should probably just at some point make America the bad guys, but we can't really do that, and so we can't really do anything with our story. So, like, just doing this whole story where I'm sitting there being like, God, you guys, if you could just make America the bad guys in these games, you would, like, so many of the narrative problems would be solved. But having to sort of hedge this weird thing of, like, American imperialism and militarism is bad, but, and it's like, well, we don't need to always put the butt on it, but these games, I don't imagine a world where they actually go all the way with that kind of thing. But it is that kind of hedging around the edges of the story that ends up making it feel sort of like, if you could turn your brain off, it's a fun action story, but you 100% have to turn your brain off in order to enjoy the story or characters part of the game, which at different points I was able to, and if you can do that, I do think it is an above-average campaign in terms of mission design and gameplay structure. Like, I don't think it's quite as good as Call of Duty 4, but it's probably in that kind of Modern Warfare 2, maybe a little bit better than Modern Warfare 2's campaign, which is still very, very good. It is only, like, particularly disappointing to me in contrast to what this team previously did with Infinite Warfare.
Yeah, and because I have been hearing mostly disappointment around the story. It sounds like it's, especially in the early hours, like very attention-grabbing with some of the violent stuff it's doing. Does it wind up using characters from the original Modern Warfare games? Because I know they hinted at Captain Price, yes. But I didn't know if they wound up doing that.
Yeah, this is one of the weirder things about the game, is it's like this sort of weird reboot in many ways of Call of Duty 4, where Captain Price is in the game. It's a completely different voice actor, and it's basically a different character, other than he's like a badass British SAS soldier. It is not in the continuity of Call of Duty 4 in those games. It is totally its own continuity, but it does have Captain Price. And then it has a couple of sort of like vague references to things from the old Modern Warfare universe. Like they will like say like, oh, there's some Russian dude like vying for power named Zakhaev that they say in like a one-off dialogue. That's like basically they're like little Easter eggs that say to me that like there's a scene at the very end of the campaign where they name drop a bunch of stuff from the old Modern Warfare games that feels like a setting up for if this game is very successful, a like new Modern Warfare 2 that would continue this story and use some of those names and kind of concepts and maybe kind of reconfigure events that you know from Modern Warfare. Because it's almost like it's this weird, like, sort of reboot of Modern Warfare, sort of, like, updated prequel to Call of Duty 4, but isn't actually, because it doesn't, like, that would not line up, but they set it up in some ways to feel almost like a prequel to the events of that story. It's very weird.
So it's like Batman Begins is to Tim Burton's Batman.
Almost like that, yes. That it's like, it's sort of a reboot, but it wants to be, like, it wants to sort of gesture to things from what you know from previously in Call of Duty, but still being its own thing. And you know, if you're, I got a mild kick out of, like, hearing someone say the name Soap in a scene that I'm like, ah, I know that dude. Yeah, Soap, right, cool. And so if, you know, if you played Call of Duty 4 and have a lot of affection for that, like, there are some fun little Easter eggs, but it is... it is mostly its own thing with, like, a couple of, like, coy references to stuff from the old games.
So this game is just called Call of Duty Modern Warfare, right?
Yes.
What do they call the sequel? Because there is already a game just called Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2.
Call that of Duty game... 5 Modern Warfare 2, that's what they call it.
No, they... yes. They finally put the 5 back in.
Yes, because Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 is where they took the number out. It's like, that's, that should be their fucking advertising slogan. Call of Duty 5 Modern Warfare 2. We're putting the 5 back in Call of Duty. We finally there, guys. It took us 10 years, but here we are. Call of Duty 5.
I'm just very curious, because if within, like, a 15-year span, we have two games just called Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, that would be amazing.
Yeah. I don't, like, I'm very curious what the larger... like, Call of Duty plan from Activision is. Like, it's felt so confused for so long at this point.
Black Ops is, like, the only solid, like, through line, basically.
Yeah, and because they set up the whole three-studio thing at the beginning of this generation with Advanced Warfare, and then that just felt like they, like, it never quite worked out for Activision or for most of, like, the hardcore Call of Duty fan base, who have only really been, like, the hardcore Call of Duty people, as far as I can tell, have only really attached themselves to the Treyarch games since, like, Black Ops 2, basically. And since Black Ops 2, which is, you know, last generation of consoles, they've been, like, the hardcore fans have been on the Treyarch train. Whereas for me, I've never particularly liked the Treyarch games that much. Like, I've played most of the campaigns at this point when I went back and just bought a bunch of old Call of Duties used and played through their campaigns one summer. Like, I like the Black Ops and Black Ops 2 campaigns. Black Ops 3's campaign, which was on PS Plus, so I played that a while ago, is, like, fine. But I don't like the feel that of Treyarch's Call of Duty. It's, like, too snappy and arcadey, and it feels too kind of, like, light and blah. I like a little bit more, like, the heavy, grounded feel that the old games had and Infinity Ward's games have still. But, yeah, but then you have, like, the Sledgehammer games, like, World War II felt like that Call of Duty game came out and everyone forgot about it. Black Ops 4 was all weird because they took the campaign out and people seemed to like it and seemed to like the blackout mode, but then kind of that feels like it didn't fully take off, and I don't hear about them, like, updating Call of Duty Black Ops 4 in big ways the way you hear about, like, when a big thing comes out for Fortnite or Overwatch or whatever, you know, the main ongoing games like Dota, League of Legends. Like, I hear about stuff like that through the grapevines when big things, or Rainbow Six Siege, when those come out for those games, I know that big updates have come out. I hear nothing about new Call of Duty games in terms of them supporting, like, Black Ops 4 or anything like that. So I'm very curious if Infinity Ward will be able to make a Call of Duty 5 Modern Warfare 2 game, or if we're going to be in the same situation where Treyarch is forced to make Black Ops because it is reliable, even though it sounds like Treyarch does not probably want to make Black Ops anymore and wants to do their own thing, I guess, at some point. But then everyone else is like, here, we get to make our game, like Advanced Warfare, and then we don't get to make Advanced Warfare 2. Then we're going to make World War 2. They're not going to make World War 2 or whatever. You know, they're not going to make a sequel to that one. We got Infinite Warfare.
World War 3, where America is the aggressor. It opens with America seizing Poland, and we just go from there.
Yes, it's a Call of Duty World War 3, but it's set in the 50s. It's an alternate 50s. It's not a future World War 3. But yeah, but we got Infinite Warfare, and then we got this one, so we didn't get a follow-up to Infinite Warfare. So I have no faith, like, as much as they sort of, like, wink and nod, like, oh, Zakayev and Soap and blah, blah, blah. It's like, I don't have a lot of confidence that Modern Warfare 2 will happen. But I am I'm invested in what happens to Call of Duty as an intellectual or, like, academic curiosity. Where does this franchise go from here? What the fuck do they do with it? Because I like this game a lot. I hope that this game serves as the foundation for other Call of Duty games. But that's where I stop for a second. I'm like, but is Treyarch going to use the engine that Infinity Ward made for this game? I don't know. And if they don't, then what the fuck is Black Ops 5? You know, like, is that going to feel like Call of Duty 4, 7 or whatever, and we're going to go back to that? Because I want a sequel to this game using the tech from this game, whether it's Modern Warfare 2 or whatever. I want this to be, like, the ground floor for Call of Duty going forward, and they can improve on the stuff from here. But I have no faith that that's actually what this franchise is going to do, which is a very weird feeling, because that's not how any other video game franchise ever works. Every other video game franchise is, we make things better and we work on the base. And, you know, not every sequel is going to be better than the previous game. But from, like, a technological standpoint, they keep on building up and evolving from a similar place. Not like, well, we're going to go do this thing, and then this studio is going to do this other thing, and the games are going to, like, feel similar, but not part of the same franchise. It's very weird.
Yeah. Who's next in the barrel? Is it Sledgehammer?
I feel like Sledgehammer is not making Call of Duty anymore. I forget, like, there's some, a story came out like a year ago with them switching that stuff up, but I don't remember how that all shook out.
Because whoever's up next is going to have to make the cross-gen PS5 game, and that went really, really poorly for Infinity Ward when they had to make Ghost, which was the PS3, PS4 game.
Yes. I want to say that the story was that Treyarch got pushed up to do the game that's going to come out next year. I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
Okay.
So,
that would be the moment to break away from Black Ops. I mean,
yeah.
That would be the moment to let them do something new. We'll see. Because they're going to... I mean, I feel like that's going to be a pretty big test, is whatever next year's Call of Duty is. Because they stumbled out of the gate this generation and then have had a very up-and-down generation since then. So,
yeah,
we shall see.
Call of Duty continues to be one of, like, the shockingly weirdest franchises in video. As much as, like, people don't, like, talk about it much and just get like, Call of Duty's just Call of Duty, that franchise has had a very weird... past like 15 years or something at this point. Like, it's we keep on thinking that Call of Duty is going to stop, and it never does, and they keep on coming up with weird ways to keep this franchise alive.
It's crazy. Yep. They made one of the best games of the decade, though, with Infinite Warfare, and we should all remember that.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, you want to move on to the news, Sean?
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
Let's start with Star Wars news. Star Wars had a big week this week. The final trailer for Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker came out. We also got the new poster for Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker, which is, I have to say, an A-plus movie poster. It's really fucking nice. And they have also given Carrie Fisher top billing for this movie, which is the coolest thing. And then tickets went on sale. I did buy my ticket for Star Wars Episode 9 because my travel plans mean I basically have one night I can see this movie, which is the night it opens. And so I was like, let's snatch that ticket. Normally, I don't care that far in advance, but it's like I have one night I can see this fucking movie. So here we go. So I'm ready. This trailer, Sean, I have to say, I was feeling kind of... I mean, we're all very burned out on Star Wars. I think we've established that on this podcast. Mm-hmm. I will say, I felt my cynicism melting away a little bit at this trailer. I thought this was a very good movie trailer. But what did you think?
It didn't. So I've got a lot of thoughts. Some I can express and some I cannot. I have a little bit of a confession I need to now make, Jonathan. A couple of months ago, I was on the toilet and bored, and I had my phone. And I saw a link on the internet that said Star Wars leaks that looked like it was bullshit. And I was like, haha, this is going to be some dumb thing for me to read for like 2 minutes or whatever while I'm on the toilet. In the way that like I often do with Doctor Who, because I've read a million bullshit. Like, my uncle works for the BBC and he says there's a falling out between Stephen Moffat and Peter Capaldi. And the end of the season is going to have Susan come back as Omega. It's like, yeah, right, sure, yes. Yeah, Doctor Who quote-unquote leaks. And the context of the way that it was written made it very clear to me that this was going to be some hot bullshit and I'd have a good time. And I read it and I was like, that maybe is a little bit too plausible. Uh-oh. And then I kind of forgot about it. And then I watched that trailer and I think I know everything that happens in this movie, Jonathan. I think I know the plot of this. I mean, a lot of like the specific details were not in there. But that, you know, the C-3PO scene from that trailer? I know that was in the leak. Like, very specifically, I know the context of that scene. And then the scene where Rey and Kylo Ren are fighting and that statue gets blown up. There's a thing in that shot that, like, is from that leak. That is no way... I cannot imagine any way that would be something made up. It's way too specific. And so I think I know what the plot of the movie is.
All right. Yeah. I am now, okay, as the producer of this podcast, I am now really torn on where we go with this conversation.
Okay.
I think editorially I cannot in good conscience have you spoil Star Wars 9 for us on this episode. So we're going to hold off on that.
Okay.
I don't think I can. But I do want to ask you, were the leaks dumb? Is that like why you're worried? Is it a dumb plot?
I think they're dumb. Yeah. I mean, it's something where it's like, it obviously will come down to execution, but there's a couple of things that I think, like, it sounds like a J.J. Abrams Star Wars Episode 9. I don't know. I don't want to, like, talk too much about it. Because there's some of that stuff might be wrong. Like, who knows? Like, I don't know. And again, it was not specific details for, like scene by scene. It was more, like, overall beats. But it's stuff of, like... So you know how when we saw the first trailer and Rey had the Anakin lightsaber again and we're like, well, they blew that up in the last movie. Well, maybe this is like, maybe they CGI'd that out or whatever. It's like, no, she has that lightsaber for basically the whole movie. Like, that's the kind of thing, you know? That's like, I'm not super excited based on what I saw from the leaks. I'm excited to see how certain pieces of information are revealed and stuff, but... I think one thing to talk about with this trailer is I think it's well put together for what it is. They have not pitched anything about this movie fucking at all. Nothing about the plot.
No, not at all.
Character arcs, anything. Like, anything. Not in a, like, I want them to give the movie away kind of thing, because now they don't need to for me. But in the way that with Star Wars The Last Jedi, like, the trailers for that movie pitched Rey is training with Luke, and Luke is, like, in this weird space where he's, like, I am going to be the last Jedi, like, this weird, like, gray space between the light and the dark, which is what that scene, like, those scenes are from the movie. They pitch that element of The Last Jedi in The Last Jedi trailers, but this is, like, The Force Awakens, where they just don't pitch anything other than Star Wars is back, yay!
Yeah, the only...
And that's it.
The thing these trailers are trying to sell is... All the characters are together, which does look fun. You cannot deny that these movies have a phenomenal cast, and it's nice to see them all on screen together. And it's pitching nostalgia, as all of these trailers do, and I think it's pitching a general sense of finality. But those are all pretty vague things to be pitching, right? Like, characters will share screen time, and general sense of finality is not a story. So yeah, like, I have no idea what the story is. I think they have said this is set a couple years after The Last Jedi, but there's no indication when this is set in the trailers. There's no indication of what, like, the state of the world is. Because I have to say, one thing I did like about this trailer is the general sense of scope I found really cool. Because I think... One of our favorite things about the prequels, especially Episode 3, is just, like, the number of ships they'll put on screen and do these big battles. And Star Wars has generally been resistant to that. This trailer has a Revenge of the Sith level of, like, ships on screen. But at the same time, how? Mm-hmm. What in Episode 7 and 8 allows there to be that many ships on screen? Because, to the best of my memory, the First Order had, like, one big Star Cruiser. And the Resistance is, like, dead at the end of The Last Jedi. So all of that confuses me, even though I thought it looked cool. But that's because they're not really pitching a story. And I don't really need them to pitch a story, but it's also, it's... I don't know, like, the Mandalorian trailer is a minute long and pitches a general sense of tone better than this. So, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, and it's stuff of, like, the C-3PO scene of where C-3PO is looking at them all. It's like, oh, I'm happy I'm with all my friends, or whatever he is that he says. It's like... You've known these people for, like, a week or something. Or, like, you know, if there's a time jump, you've spent, like, a year of off-screen time, I guess, together with these people. But I have, not even that much investment in most of the on-screen relationships anymore because, like, you know, Rey and Finn spend, like, a whole movie without ever seeing each other, basically, in The Last Jedi. So it's, like, a lot of those character relationships I'm not super invested in. But I care about seeing Rey and Finn and Poe. And, like, I like those guys and I want to see them do stuff on screen together. I have no relationship or no, like, investment in the relationship between C-3PO and Rey or Finn
or any of them. Have Rey and C-3PO ever met?
I have no idea.
I don't think they have.
And so that scene in the trailer just is so, like, you know, it's talking to the audience or whatever and being like, oh, we like C-3PO. But, and that's, like, I guess kind of what I mean by, like, the J.J. Abrams-iness of it is, like, there's not a, like grounded core storytelling sensibility or something to it of like, yes, I care about C-3PO, but nobody in this sequence shown in the trailer has any investment in C-3PO. So the emotion in the storytelling sense is incredibly hollow. Like, if Luke was there and Han was there and Leia was there, then yes, I would be like, oh my god, oh, C-3PO, I want to give you a big hug, you weird robot guy. But, I mean, all those people are basically dead at this point. So yeah. It's like, you can't... Like it's that kind of thing of where them trying to build this as the end of the saga of like the 9-movie saga. I don't feel like episodes 7 and 8 do anything to set up a movie that feels like the end of the 9 episodes or the 9-movie saga of Star Wars as a whole. The sequel trilogy feels so detached from the rest of that to me. I feel like they haven't done a good job. If that was their goal, to make this feel like connected. And then, like, trying to bring the Emperor back as a villain, even though he just blew up at the end of the Return of the Jedi, and do that and have, like, this speech by C-3PO and all that kind of stuff. Like, that, to me, doesn't have the emotional investment, maybe, that J.J. Abrams is going to want it to have.
Well, it all comes from the decision to do the sequel trilogy as a game of Exquisite Corpse, which is, if you don't know, yeah. The Dadaist game of, like, you start a drawing and then hand it off to another artist and they continue the drawing and you wind up with a really weird detached drawing. That's what they've decided to do. And so Abrams made a pretty good, like, place setter in Force Awakens. And then Rian Johnson had to go off of that. And so he's limited in some ways. And I think you and I pretty much agree that he made all the best decisions to make a really good movie in The Last Jedi. Mm-hmm. But The Last Jedi also is not in any way interested with table setting episode 9, right? Like, it is very much its own thing. And I'm fine with that if they were doing this in a slightly different way. But Disney wanted it to be the middle chapter in a trilogy, which Last Jedi functionally is not. That's not how it sets itself up. And so now you have to do this and pretend that we kind of made a trilogy, but we really didn't. And, like, the original Star Wars trilogy wasn't planned out either. But just look at it. It's structured like a trilogy. It's got a very clear beginning, middle, end.
Yeah, and George Lucas...
did all of it, yeah.
...guided the trilogy, right? Like, he didn't direct all the movies, but he was heavily involved in the production of all 6 of those movies, yes. Right? And so this is... like, not only are these... is it kind of the game of Exquisite Corpse, but you also don't have George Lucas's direct, like, involvement for the first time. Like, it's not him, like, having his hand on these movies and guiding things and making decisions.
Yeah.
So like, it naturally sort of feels really weird and all over the place. Because I've seen people, like, when people complain about the sequel trilogy, about the sense of, like, like, there's a trilogy of movies, this feels disjointed. And they're like, but the original trilogy felt that way, too. And it's like...
no, it doesn't.
Yes. Well, it doesn't. The ways that it does are bad. Like, the just throwing Leia out as Luke's sister in Return of the Jedi is fucking dumb. And they shouldn't have done it. But it also doesn't feel disjointed in the ways that this trilogy has felt disjointed. Especially because, like, going J.J. Abrams to Rian Johnson, then back to J.J. Abrams, I think, is going to be weird in how you get shit like Luke's or Anakin's lightsaber being destroyed in Last Jedi and Rey just hot gluing it together again. I don't know. Like, that's something I don't know how she put the lightsaber back together again. I also don't know how she got the lightsaber in the first place after it fell fucking into the heart of the cloud giant of Bespin. Still pissed off about that. I will never not let that go.
In The Last Jedi was out in the blackness of space. So, like, that lightsaber just has some kind of magnetic power to Jedi. It's fucking bizarre.
Yes, so that lightsaber somehow being back, even though... Because I literally, after that trailer and me thinking about this stuff, I listened back to that part of our conversation in the Last Jedi podcast. Just because I was like, I wonder how we talked about some of this stuff now that I know basically the core, like, beats of what's going to happen in The Rise of Skywalker. And us talking about that lightsaber scene was very funny because we both go on a big thing about how, like, thank God this lightsaber's dead. Rey can finally just get her own lightsaber. She can have her own lightsaber for the next movie. And it's like, fucking God. Like, how do you... It's like J.J. Abrams trying to put spilled milk back into the fucking bottle. It's like, no, she just has the lightsaber again. Like, I really like Kylo Ren's mask, so he just has his fucking mask again. Why? I don't really know, but he just has his fucking helmet back on, even though he destroyed it in the last movie and was like, I'm letting go of this whatever, you know? Like, it's that sense of what this movie is doing that they show in the trailers is very frustrating.
Yeah, I'm just...
of, not wanting to sort of carry on some of those qualities of the last movie and trying to like kind of stitch things back together the way that J.J. Abrams wanted it to be so that he gets to tell the story that he wanted to tell.
Okay, tell me one thing from the leaks. Do they...
Are you sure you want to ask me this?
Yeah,
are
I, you do, sure? I do want to ask you this.
Okay, okay.
Skip
okay.
it. Listeners, I trust you. You trust me. We're a happy family, to quote Barney the Dinosaur. Sean, do they do a 180 on Rey's parentage?
I'm going to give you a second chance to pull out of this, Jonathan.
Well,
are you 100% sure?
Then I think that's the answer, but yes. No, just tell me so I can... I need to adjust. I think this will be better, Sean, in the long run if you and I are adjusting our levels of disillusionment at the same level.
Okay, I'm going to do this in two stages. The first stage, yes. He 180s on that. Do you want to know how? Do you want to know who?
Oh my God. Okay, we're past... I think we're past the Rubicon. Just tell me.
She is the granddaughter of Palpatine.
Fucking...
Yep. Uh-huh.
Fucking... What?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
What? Who'd Palpatine have sex with? What?
I don't know, but he had a kid, and that kid had sex, and that was Rey. It came out of that one.
I mean, okay. There's a chance this isn't true, right? I mean, let's just be...
Oh, there's a chance. I am pretty confident about that one. I think, again, because this can't possibly be a spoiler. There is a knife that Rey is holding in the scene where she is fighting Kylo Ren in the trailer. That knife is heavily detailed in the plot description in the leak. There is no world in which someone just made up that she would have this ancient Sith knife that would do a thing for the plot. So I am pretty positive, because most of the leak was hinged upon that revelation.
So listeners, you know, we don't do video podcasts here, but if we did, you would have seen this is the closest I've ever come to walking away from a podcast of getting up and leaving. Oh my God.
Man, I really did expect to reveal this information on the plot. Like, I was going to say that I knew the plot and, like, very distantly not say it, because I couldn't defy you if you asked me directly.
But, like, Sean, once you've let the cat out of the bag, I couldn't, I just, it's where the conversation led.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So now you get, now you know what I mean by, I'm very excited to see, like, how this information is revealed. But yes, that tells you like what the philosophy of this movie is like not to follow on from the interesting ideas of The Last Jedi, just to sort of like put the filled milk back in the bottle and let's do our Star Wars movie and get on with our lives is kind of what, like, I'm excited for it to be out so that we don't have to talk about these movies, because I'm just tired of period of Star Wars, and I want it to be done and us to do something different with Star Wars.
It's going
to
be a very Star Wars heavy fall, because on November 12th, we get The Mandalorian. On November 15th, we get Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order. And on December 20th, we get The Rise of Lil Palpatine.
Little baby Palpatine.
Let's just move the fuck on. All right.
Okay.
Sean, this is ruined. Oh, this is you've ruined my fucking day. God damn
you,
it.
I gave you like five chances to back out, and you kept on saying, yes, this is on you, not
no,
me.
No, I want to be clear. Ultimately, this will be better for, I think, everyone listening, because the disappointment has been deferred from December 19th to now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's...
I am, like, 99% sure I'm going to enjoy the movie much, much better having had that plot leaked, because I'm not... Like, at the very least, the podcast is not on that movie is not only going to be us screaming about Rey's parentage for the whole thing. No. Like, that's what that podcast would have been if we had gone into that movie blind.
Yeah, no, I mean... Yeah, this is like the Game of Thrones leaks, right? Where I enjoyed Game of Thrones so much more once I just started reading the leaks. Okay, let's move on with the fucking news. I'm so distracted now. A bunch of games got delayed. So we're on to video. I'm going to do a bad job for the rest of this podcast. I'm just going to tell you guys. So, in addition to Doom Eternal's recent delay from November to March, The Last of Us Part 2, which only a few weeks after its initial announcement from February 2020, has been pushed now 3 whole months to May 29th, 2020. And then Ubisoft, the next day, announced that Watch Dogs Legion, Gods and Monsters, and Rainbow Six Quarantine have all been delayed to their fiscal 2020 year, meaning that they will come out sometime between April 2020 and March 2021. Watch Dogs had been scheduled for March, so it's at least a one-month delay for that. But Ubisoft has had kind of a rough year, and clearly they have decided to write off fiscal year 2019, and they're just pushing everything to 2020. But that's kind of funny, Sean. We went a year or two in this generation with, like, no delays, and now it's delays kind of galore all at one time. I think The Last of Us 1 is the weirdest thing. I've never seen a game get a date and then, like, 2 weeks later get delayed 3 months. That was bizarre.
Yeah, it's very weird. You have to, like, wonder about what the conversations were like internally, because you know that they were like, we probably are going to have to delay this game, and then it's like was coming right up to the wire when they had scheduled the press event, and they're like, nah, let's try to hit that February date, and then like 2 days later they're looking at actually what they need to do, and like, oh shit, let's push it back. And like, the good thing is that, you know, Sony lets that with their devs. Like, Sony is very willing to delay the games, their first party games. Like, I have no, like, concerns about
no.
it. Like, my only concerns are for, like, the extra crunch now that the developers at Naughty Dog are going to have to do to hit that further release date. But in terms of the quality of the game, Naughty Dog has such an immaculate track record with that kind of stuff. Like, certainly in terms of, like, bugs and glitches and stuff, like, their games are always completely rock solid. So, you know, like, it's a little bit of a bummer because I did want to play that game sooner rather than later. But it makes, you know, it opens up that early 2020 window a little bit.
I'm totally fine with it, Sean, because nothing ever comes out in late May or June, and now we have a really good game coming out late May, which is also almost exactly 7 years to the day from when Last of Us 1 launched. So I yep. think that is actually a better window for the game, but I do think it's funny. I wonder if, like, Naughty Dog, like, if Sony came to Naughty Dog and were like, all right, we're going to announce tomorrow, February 2020. You guys okay with that? Just one last time. They're like, yeah, sure. And then the Sony rep left the room, and then, like, someone walked up to Neil Druckmann and, like, tapped him on the shoulder and was like, there's a problem. And then, like, turns around and then, like, fuck, while they're announcing the game. But yes, whatever happened, I'm totally... obviously, Sony being willing to delay games is why Sony's games are so good. It's one big yeah. part of that. What's going on with Ubisoft?
Yeah, this... like, the Ubisoft one is the thing that's, like, really, like, more kind of concerning to me is the... do they, like... It feels like that means that, like, 2019 to early 2020 is just, like, emptied for them now, basically. Like, they just kind of, like, they just grabbed everything and shoved it back. And, like, in such this, like, indeterminate way. I mean, part of it is that this was not, like, a press release for the press is how this was revealed. This was on their, like, fiscal call, basically. So this was more for people, like, invested in the studio to hear about. So it's not, like, messaged particularly well, but this, like, oh, they're going to come out the fiscal year of 2020 to 2021 is such a vague, like, and this big, like, group of games that was basically all the games they showed off more or less at, E3 last summer are now getting pushed. And so this is more concerning. Is just the sort of, like, evacuation of Ubisoft games from the next few months into some indeterminate period in the future. And it does feel like they got kind of spooked by The Division 2 and particularly Ghost Recon Breakpoint doing really poorly. It seems to just sort of, like, scared Ubisoft in a weird way.
Well, what it means, like, just financially, the only reason you would do this is if you are so far in the hole for 2019 that these games couldn't get you out of the hole. So the idea mm-hmm. is that, let's just say 2019 was a giant chasm. We write off 2019, and then we put everything, all our eggs in the 2020 basket so it can look like we had massive growth from 2019 to 2020, right? So,
yeah.
Because otherwise, like, I think Watch Dogs Legion will do well wherever it comes out. That game is already being very well marketed. But if Watch Dogs Legion comes out March, it might get them closer to being out of the red, but I think they knew they weren't going to get all the way out of the red. So Watch Dogs Legion could, from a stockholder perspective, only help them so much. In 2020, with a clean slate, it could kick off. Because I'm guessing it's going to be like an April, May release now. And what it probably will do is kick off a 2020. They're going to have a new Assassin's Creed next year. They're going to have new consoles that are going to drive everything. Like, I mean, Ubisoft doesn't sell the consoles, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They will probably have a very good 2020, and then it can look like we rebounded from a bad 2019. But yeah, Ubisoft has had a really bad 2019. It's kind of amazing. Division 2 and Ghost Recon Breakpoint, and they that call, they also were very open about how Breakpoint was a failure. Really fascinating. And yeah, Ubisoft has generally been pretty consistent this generation. They've had successes and failures, but I think been pretty consistent. So this is an interesting one, and yeah, I'm curious to see what comes of it.
Yeah, it's like you said, it had been a while since we got this kind of news from a developer. It's been very sort of like delay free for the past like year or so. And yeah, just having like this weird sort of like Last of Us 2. Oh, that's weird. Every Ubisoft game. Oh no, what? It was like, oh yeah, video game delays. Video games are normal again. They're getting pushed. The game companies are floundering in weird ways.
Yeah.
Video games are here.
I have to say, you know, 2013 will be the comparable year to 2020, because 2013 was the last year of the previous gen, and then at the end the PS4 launched. Now 2020,
yeah.
Last year the PS4, PS5 will launch. 2013 was not a super busy year. It had some really dense points like Last of Us and BioShock Infinite and stuff like that. 2020 is an insane final year for a generation. Like, 2020 is shaping up to look more like a mid-generation crest year than it is the end of a generation kind of put your last gasps out year. It's very, and I also wonder how that will affect people's willingness to buy a new hardware. If it feels like the old hardware is really healthy and vibrant, like maybe that'll make them want the PS5 even more, because they'll be more playing video games. But I also wonder if it'll be like, well, I've bought like 5 games for my PS4 this year, why do I need a PS5? So I'm very curious how that will break out.
Yeah, that's where I think the backwards compatibility is going to be very useful.
Yeah.
For them, from like a marketing perspective, is the, oh yeah, like, you know, because this means that Ghost of Tsushima is going to come out probably like August, maybe, or August or September.
Yeah.
So it's gonna, that game's going to bump up real close to the PS4 or the PS5 launch, presumably. So they'll be able to be like, oh, you can buy it and play it on your PS4, and then when the PS5 comes out, you can play it in an even nicer way on your PS5. Like, that's kind of how I think they're going to spin some of this stuff.
I feel like the smartest thing they could do with Ghost of Tsushima right now is just make it cross-platform and have it launch on launch day for PS5, so they could have something really impressive first party to launch the PS5 with, like their Breath of the Wild was to Switch. And I wonder if they'll be able to do that. I wonder if that's in the works at all. But I am very curious where that comes out. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm also just curious because we haven't heard, like, what is Sony's, like, I'm guessing probably, like, Horizon 2 is what we're going to get. But I'm curious to see, like, when are we going to find out what their actual launch games and, like, launch window is going to look like for Sony to pitch that. Because this news of Last of Us and Ghost of Tsushima getting pushed back made me realize, oh, right, we have, like, no idea what they are actually, like, holding for that launch window.
Killzone Shadowfall 2. We're finally getting it.
Yep, Killzone Shadowfall 2 and Knack 3. Here we go.
Oh god, there was a Knack 2, wasn't there?
There was a Knack 2, yes.
Alright, one other piece of video game news that was so exciting to me personally, I just had to put it out here. There's a company called Analog that has been making for a couple years now very acclaimed what are essentially clone consoles of classic video game consoles. They made the Super NT and the Mega SG platforms. What those do is they clone the original Super NES and Genesis hardware, respectively. And when I say clone, because they're not emulation platforms. They're very specifically not emulation. It is all hardware solutions through what's called an FGPA chip. And they can play every SNES cartridge, every Genesis cartridge, like exactly perfectly to the original specifications, but they scale up to 1080p TVs, use HDMI, all that stuff. They're very expensive, but for people who have collected Super NES and Genesis games, they swear by these platforms, and they seem really impressive. I had been kind of looking at them from afar because I don't own a lot of SNES cartridges. I own zero Genesis cartridges, so I had no reason to buy those. But now Analog is coming from my wallet specifically, because they have just announced a console called the Analog Pocket. This will be a handheld that can play all 2,780 plus Game Boy, Game Boy Color, and GBA game cartridges. It will also have adapters available at launch to play Game Gear, Neo Geo Pocket, and Atari Lynx game, engineered using that same FGPA solution to perfectly recreate original hardware without emulation. It looks sort of like an original Game Boy. It kind of looks like if Apple designed a Game Boy. It's like a very sleek look. The screen is 3.5 inches in size. It has 615 PPI, so an extremely high pixels per inch. And it is a 1600 by 1440 resolution, which is higher than pretty much any... I think that's the resolution of my MacBook that I am using right now. Like, it is an insanely dense resolution for a 3.5-inch screen, and that is also a full 10 times the resolution of the original Game Boy. It will have a port for the original Link cable, it'll charge via USB-C, and it will also have a dock to connect to the TV, available separately, a la the Nintendo Switch. Sean, they made something for me specifically. I think.
Yes, they basically made the, like, Ferrari of Game Boys. Yeah, which, like, again, like, something to stress is that the way this works is it's basically you are buying, like, a super high-end Game Boy.
Yes.
So it's not something where it's, like, you just download a bunch of files and, like, put them on a USB stick or something. You are putting actual Game Boy hard cartridges into the machine to play them. So it is, you know, because it is hard to get actual Game Boys, ones that, you know, aren't broken in different ways, and you just want, like, some ridiculous, like, super nice presentation of them that are going to look much, much better than the original hardware could have ever actually displayed them. This is, like, for enthusiasts only, if you want your, like, what is, I think, a higher, like, resolution per screen size than the fucking iPhone.
Yes.
If you want that for your Game Boy games, this is the device for you.
And I do. I have a big Game Boy collection. I have probably 50 carts altogether, maybe more. I'd have to, like, look and add them up. And I actually, Sean, since they announced this, I have been quietly buying some carts on eBay of things, like, I only have on emulator that I want to have for this. Because I've always wanted something like this. Not necessarily this high-end. I would have settled for less. But this is still fucking great, especially that it'll dock to play on a 1080p TV. It's so cool. And just, like, I have so many Game Boy games I love that I will be very excited to play this way. Obviously not for everybody. It is very, very, very much for me. It's $200 is what it's going to cost, so it's very expensive. That's the price of a Nintendo Switch Lite. For most people, I would recommend buy the Switch Lite. It will play new games. But if you, like me, just, you know, you really want to play Dragon Ball Z The Legacy of Goku 2 at that resolution, I'm kidding. But yes, that'll be great. And honestly, I mean, if you wanted to invest in old hardware at all, like, playing Game Boy games on your TV has become really expensive because there's the Game Boy, the Super Game Boy for the SNES, which you can get cheaply, but that only plays original Game Boy, not Color or Advance. The Game Boy Player for the GameCube is super rare now and really hard to find. So, like, this is actually cheaper than a lot of the alternatives of trying to get this stuff working on your TV. So I am excited someone is doing this. That is, yes, the Ferrari of Game Boys is the right way to put it, Sean. And yeah, I have not. I'm actually, this made me more excited than the PS5 announcement. If I'm just talking about, like, my personal, like, this is for me. It's crazy. But yeah, I'm sure someone listening will feel the same way. All right, you want to talk some movie news, Sean?
Yes, what's going on in the world of movies, Jonathan?
Well, they're gearing up for the new Batman movie. This is the Matt Reeves movie. Matt Reeves, director of the recent Planet of the Apes movies, Cloverfield, the Let the Right One In remake, all those good things. He's a good director. He's making a new Batman movie. We already knew Robert Pattinson was going to be playing Bruce Wayne Batman. And now we are getting more casting news as they are gearing up to shoot this thing. Officially, we have Zoe Kravitz has been cast as Catwoman. Paul Dano, the little shit from There Will Be Blood, has been cast as the Riddler. Robert Pattinson, of course, is Batman. The Penguin is heavily rumored to be involved, too. For a while, they were looking at Jonah Hill, and then Jonah Hill backed out. And I think it was rumored that he was asked to play the Penguin. I don't think I've heard any rumors of who they're trying to get now. But so they are looking at Catwoman, Riddler, Penguin, which means they are one villain away from doing the same four-villain lineup as the Batman 66 movie. Which really makes me want the scene where Robert Pattinson runs around in a cloth Batman suit trying to get rid of a bomb.
Just like, but like a deeply dramatic, self-serious version of, some days, Robin, I just can't get rid of a bomb.
Yes. Everything I've heard about this movie from people who have like looked at the script and stuff is that I think Matt Reeves wants to take Batman in a more fun direction. I doubt it will be like pop, colorful Joel Schumacher, but I think more fun than, like, Chris Nolan or Zack Snyder. And certainly that lineup of villains, I think, kind of indicates that. They might even be doing some stuff with the Bat family, which would be cool. But I do have to say, when they announced Catwoman, I was a little bit like, okay, Zoe Kravitz is good casting. That's an interesting choice. But this is our fourth Catwoman since 1992. And then, you know, they announced Paul Dano as the Riddler. And I'm just like, I've seen a million fucking Riddlers, and I also do not like Paul Dano. I know some people like Paul Dano. I like him in one movie, and it's There Will Be Blood, and it's because the entire movie he spends getting the shit kicked out of him, which is the only position Paul Dano should ever be in. He has the most punchable face I've ever seen, which is also, I guess, pretty good for the Riddler. So, good casting. But it does just make you wonder, like, Batman has one of the biggest rogues galleries and one of the best, and Hollywood knows about maybe five of them. So, Sean, do you want to walk with me through every Batman live-action theatrical feature villain?
Sure. Yes. Why not?
Just to go through how repetitive the movies have been, okay? So let's start. First Batman movie ever, live-action Batman movie, is Batman 66 with Adam West. That movie had the Joker, played by Cesar Romero, the Penguin, played by Burgess Meredith, Catwoman, played by Lee Merriweather, and Riddler, played by Frank Gorshin. So we've got four villains to start. Then we jump ahead to 1989. We have the Joker again, played by Jack Nicholson. So Joker number two. Then in Batman Returns, 92, you have Penguin again in Danny DeVito, and you have Catwoman again in Michelle Pfeiffer. Then in Batman Forever in 95, you get the Riddler again as Jim Carrey. And finally, we get a new villain. We get Two-Face, Tommy Lee Jones. All right. Batman and Robin actually is the most original Batman movie up to this point for villains since the 1966, because Poison Ivy, as played by Uma Thurman, sort of Bane, I don't know if you really want to call that character Bane, they call him Bane though, and Mr. Freeze are all new to the world of movies. The Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mr. Freeze. All right, so they're all new.
Yes.
Then you get Batman Begins, also pretty original. Scarecrow, played by Cillian Murphy, and Ra's al Ghul, played by Liam Neeson, both new. Then you do Dark Knight, and we have Joker again, Joker number three, played by Heath Ledger, and Two-Face again, played by Aaron Eckhart. Then you go to The Dark Knight Rises, and we have Bane for a second time, played by Tom Hardy. We have Catwoman again, played by Anne Hathaway, and I completely forgot there is a standalone Catwoman movie with Halle Berry, so this is technically Catwoman number four already. And you have Talia al Ghul, sort of. So we can count her if we want.
Right, yes.
Then in Suicide Squad, you have Joker again, played by Jared Leto. So that's Joker number four. And you have Harley Quinn, played by Margot Robbie. Then you have the Joker movie. And I have to say, I'm counting a villain if they come in contact with Batman, which he technically does in Joker because he meets little Bruce Wayne. So you have Joker again, played by Joaquin Phoenix, Joker number five. In the new Batman movie, you will have Catwoman again, played by Zoe Kravitz, and you will have Riddler again, played by Paul Dano, and possibly Penguin again. Pick some new fucking villains, guys. Come on. Where is our Penny Pincher
when
movie?
Will Man-Bat have his day? Man-Bat. Give me Man-Bat.
Give me the Penny Pincher. I want him.
Yeah. Do you mean the Penny Plunder?
It doesn't really matter, but yeah.
Penny Pincher would be a better name, now that you said it, that they should have called him the Penny Pincher. I can't believe that they went with Penny Plunderer. Yeah. Maybe Penny Pincher wasn't a slang term or something in the 40s, when the last time Penny Plunderer made an appearance in a comic book. Give me Man-Bat. I mean, give me Clayface. I'm surprised they've never done Clayface. That seems like one you'd go to.
King Tut.
You could do the Mad Hatter. The Mad Hatter would be good. Or go for something more modern. Do the fucking Court of Owls or Hush or something. Like something that is more from like a comic book written when people were alive, yeah. You know, from like the past 20, 30 years, instead of going to only the classic villains, do something more recent.
Yeah, do Hugo Strange. They've never done Hugo Strange. That's kind of weird.
Yep, that's a good one.
Yeah, there's a lot that they have never done, and I'm sure this new movie will be good and entertaining, and that is all good casting, but I just, at a certain point, it's like, Batman is more than those original four or five villains, guys. Come on. This is crazy. Can you imagine if Star...
I can't wait till...
Can you imagine if Star Wars was still doing the Emperor?
Very good. Very good.
All right. Anyway, any other thoughts on that?
You know, I'm with you. It's just like, I mean, we have so many Batman movies that at some point, you know, go do something else. Although this did remind me of all those reports that came out about a week ago about Jared Leto trying to kill the Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie. And that was very fun. I really enjoyed reading all of those. And this reminded me of that. So I'm very happy right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I was very torn reading that Jared Leto story. Because on the one hand, I kind of wish he had succeeded in killing it because it's a bad movie. But on the other hand, if he had, then we probably would have gotten more Jared Leto as Joker. So it's just, it's all bad. But I think ultimately the right people won in that particular fight because Jared Leto is a little prick and I'm glad he is sad.
Yeah, because after those news stories came out, I realized that since I'd never seen Suicide Squad, I'd never actually seen anything of his version of the Joker that wasn't like the 15 seconds of footage from the trailers or whatever. So I went on YouTube and just like Googled Jared Leto Joker and found like the longest scene I could. And I think it was the scene that has the shot where he's like laying in the circle of knives or whatever. He's bad.
Oh, he's really bad.
That's a bad performance. Yeah. It's like really like, this is awful.
The scene with him and Harley Quinn in the club. That is like prime bad Jared Leto. It's funny how bad it is.
Okay, I'll have to look for some more performance because I just realized like I just always assumed that his performance was terrible because it seemed like it was and people said it was, but I hadn't actually seen it myself, and then I saw it myself. I'm like, nope, yep, it's very bad. They made the right choice in not doing anything else with that version of that character.
It's the one bad Joker. Like, I don't like the Joker movie, but Joaquin Phoenix is obviously very good in it. So not really playing the Joker, but whatever. All right, Sean, let's end this podcast with a little dessert. You want to have a little dessert, Sean?
I very much do, because I thought this is something that broke earlier today, and it put a big smile on my face for probably all the wrong reasons, but I still found it very amusing.
All right. David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, the two gentlemen who wrote Game of Thrones, the TV show, appeared at the Austin Film Festival this weekend, and as chronicled by Twitter user Needle and Pen, you can find them at @4aria, the results were hilariously maddening. Let's share some of the details, Sean. Let's start with something simple. Jason Momoa, who we all love, was cast as Khal Drogo in the first season of Game of Thrones based on a suggestion from fan casting pages online. Now, that worked out. Khal Drogo's great. Mm-hmm. We all love Jason Momoa as Khal Drogo. That gave us Jason Momoa into the world. That's a good thing. But I don't know if that's a great sign that the Chuckle Fucks making this show just went to fan casting pages to cast their show. That's a little weird. All right.
Yeah, usually you have people that are, you know, casting directors that cast people because that's their job and they're good at it.
Then it gets worse. Benioff, describing a pre-meeting with George R.R. Martin, who was questioning their being Benioff and Weiss bona fides to make this show, and quote, "We didn't really have any. We had never done TV and we didn't have any. We don't know why he trusts us with his life's work." Good point. Good point, Mr. Benioff. We don't know why.
Yep.
Okay, so a little background on this next one, Sean. The pilot of Game of Thrones was famously troubled. And when I say the pilot of Game of Thrones, none of us have ever seen the actual pilot. What you've seen on, like, in season one, the first episode, Winter is Coming, is mostly a reshot version of what was the original pilot they sold to HBO. That pilot had different casting, it had different writing, and that pilot was famously rough. Like, Benioff and Weiss have gotten down on themselves many times over the years over how bad that pilot was. Like, it's kind of famous. But what they said about it here was fucking hilarious, because they talked about the pilot and acknowledged that the first pilot was just basic writing mistakes. They acknowledged that they had no idea why, after such a dismal pilot, why they went forward at HBO. Quote, everything we could make a mistake in, we did. End quote. The script, the casting, the costumes. They think HBO went forward because they had a lot of foreign pre-sales on the series, which is so sad to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Here is the quote that I think grabbed a lot of attention this morning, was Weiss saying that Game of Thrones was, quote, basically an expensive film school for he and Dave. For example, they had no idea how to work with costume designers, and it was a huge learning experience. Yeah.
And this is like the tenor of most of this, is that sort of white male privilege, like, how did they get this job? It seems like nobody knows. It seems like nobody understands how these two guys got to make this TV show, because they had no experience, no qualifications, nothing at all to indicate that they would be able to run a big TV show like this. And they just, like...
It gets better.
Somehow, they just got it.
It gets better. 2 months before the pilot was set to air, the episodes as edited were averaging 39 minutes, and HBO made them write and film 100 minutes of scenes to meet their contractual obligations. For example, they added a scene in the first season with Robert and Cersei, and realized that there had previously been no scene between the two of them, the husband and wife pair who kick off the entire series because she kills him, and they had never written a scene between the two of them. How did this work for as long as it did, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, it is just... It makes my experience watching Game of Thrones illuminating in some ways, of the feeling of like how disjointed the show felt at most times. Because basically the narrative that this paints for me about the production of that show is that it was led by two people who had been effectively incompetent the entire time, and their incompetence was only exposed in the end game when they didn't have anybody that was covering their ass. Because it seems like everybody else working on the show was exceptionally talented. Yes. And it was these two fuckheads that just didn't really know what they were doing.
And in the early going, they were transcribing very good source material. So, like, you could only fuck it up so much, right?
Yeah, that's part of what I mean by everybody else around them was exceptionally talented. One of the main ones being George R. R. Martin creating the source material that they're drawing from. And then, like, all the set designers and costume designers and the actors, for sure, like, being so phenomenal. Because there's a lot of stuff in here about how the actors fucking basically wrote their characters in some ways.
The moderator asked why Benioff and Weiss chose to write all the episodes by themselves instead of using a writer's room. Quote, because we didn't know better. David said HBO wanted them to hire other writers, and they decided to have Brian Cogman, their assistant, write episodes instead. They were also asked about not including women and people of color in the writer's room. They said they didn't have a writer's room, and there was one woman who wrote a few scenes, but then she went off and did other things. That woman, by the way, wrote The Shape of Water and won an Oscar for it. They didn't have a writer's room. They decided up front it was going to just be the two of them, other than Brian Cogman and then David Hill, who they noted is of Asian descent. So that fixes everything, Sean. So, again, HBO offered them money to have a writer's room, and they said no. Great. All right. Yep. Weiss wanted to remove as many fantasy elements as possible because, quote, we didn't just want to appeal to that type of fan, end quote. They wanted to expand the fan base to people beyond the fantasy fan base, to mothers, NFL players, etc. When they pitched HBO, they promised HBO that they would downplay the fantasy elements, which I also think is a huge problem down the home stretch of Game of Thrones, in that the story has all this fantasy in it that they have no interest in paying off or doing anything with. Like, I don't know, one of the main characters being resurrected from the fucking dead that they never mention again.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, and I want to hang on that one just really quick, because also I feel like that perspective of, oh, you know, people who are outside the fantasy fan base, like mothers and NFL players, is like, one, NFL players are nerds. Like, lots of them are massive. Like, people that are really into sports are massive nerds, because that's what sports is. And... plenty of mothers are really into nerdy stuff, but also, like, Harry Potter and Star Wars are fantasy, and they're like the biggest media fucking franchises on the planet. Like, fantasy appeals to everybody. It's just different kinds of fantasy. So the idea of downplaying the fantasy elements to try to appeal to, like to not to just like appeal to a different fan base, but try to appeal to more people is stupid, because that's not how it works. Like, you're trying to aim at whatever demographic you're aiming at that's going to be interested in the specific show you're making, but saying that the more fantasy you put in the show, the more narrow your audience is like objectively not true. It's so it's like such a dumb fucking thing to say that is in no way cognizant of how the like the dynamics of genre fiction actually operates, and they're lumping lots of things in together that are not together, and it's stupid and annoying.
Yep. And Sean, finally, here I think is the most maddening part. Question from the moderator. Did you really sit down and try to boil the elements of the books down? Did you really try to understand its major elements? Response from Chucklefucks. No, we didn't. The scope was too big. It was about the scenes we were trying to depict, and the show was about power. Question, what was your process? Answer, we just started writing. But as things went on, we had to outline, divvied up scripts. The two writers, we did not work together in the same room. One took the first half of the episode, the other took the last half, and then we would swap back and forth, and then give a couple episodes to Brian Cogman and David Hill. So they didn't start outlining until later on. So, you know, we've talked a lot about how the organizing principle of Game of Thrones is not the episode or the season, it's the scene. And that apparently was by design, because they didn't look yep. further than just, let's take individual scenes and put them on screen. What the motherfuck is... How did HBO trust them with this? Like, here's the biggest question that I will always want answered, is when Benioff and Weiss made it clear they were unwilling to continue Game of Thrones between a shortened season 7 and 8. Why did HBO not kick them out and bring in new people? Because they would have been well within their right. There would have been no legal issues there. They could have just said, we're hiring new people, and they will finish the show. Why did HBO... Like, the only reason you don't do that is if the people involved are so supremely talented, there's like an upside to it. These people are like manifestly incompetent by their own admission. And HBO was like, yes, we will cut off the most popular show we have ever had or will ever have just because they think it might be a good idea, even though they're idiots. How did this happen, Sean?
I have no idea, because it is like the response to did you sit down and try to boil the elements of the books down, and just saying, no, the scope was too big. And then in the next question saying, oh, later on we figured out we had to outline. It's like, well, if you learned how to outline at the beginning, that's what we mean by boiling it down to its core elements. Like, that's how you take something that has a very big scope and you boil it down to something that's more manageable. You create fucking outlines, basically. And so it is like, it's so, again, like, it felt very, like, you know, simpatico with my viewing experience of Game of Thrones this summer, which is that, like, the man, this is like, occasionally the show is amazing, and then it was often then like awful, but like in scenes that could be right next to each other, there's no focus, there's no, like, you know, saying that the show was about power is funny, because I mean, they're not wrong, but that's true of every story, in a particular reading of narrative, that is true of literally every story you could possibly create, is that the story is going to be about power. And so not having anything more like sort of refined or specific to hone that for episodes or for the show as a whole, again, is very revealing about how you get to the end, and you have like the most like classically historical wet fart of an ending in modern memory, is that you don't know what it is the show that you're making. And so, like, having, like, all these supremely talented people just sort of hitched to this fucking car that, when, you know, they're not really sort of in full control of everything that's happening, it goes really fine and swimmingly. But then once they are in full control, they're just driving straight off the cliff and you have nothing you can do about it. It makes me feel like it's, like, tragic for all the other people involved with this fucking thing.
But hey, Sean, themes are for 8th grade book reports, am I right?
Yep. No, yeah, if you like heard that quote that was coming around on Twitter earlier this year, and like were like, that seems like a weird thing to say, this, like, all these answers feel like, okay, that's just who these people are, because these are the same people that said that quote are answering these questions in this way.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. I am going to go bang my head against that wall until I have burned all memory of Star Wars as a franchise out of it, because I don't want to live in a world with Star Wars anymore after what we learned earlier today. So, Sean, you go ahead and close the show. I'm going to go bang my head against the wall.
Okay. Time for me to find more Star Wars leaks. Thanks, guys, for listening to the show. This has been the Weekly Stuff Podcast. Jonathan's forehead is bleeding horribly. Yeah. Thanks, I guess.